We're looking at the biological forces at work. What drives us to do the things we do? It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Every cell in our body contains the same 21,000 or so genes that give or take. We're looking at the many different influences, biological and environmental, that all dramatically affect how our genes are expressed. So what do you know about who you are? Have you ever taken a DNA test where it walks you through which health issues your genetics might be make you more susceptible to? What questions do you have about how the world around you affects how you act? Join in at 800-642-1234. Bill Sullivan is a pharmacology and microbiology professor at the Indiana University School of Medicine, where he studies genetics and infectious disease. His new book is called Pleased to Meet Me: Genes, Germs, and the Curious Forces That Make Us Who We Are. Bill, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, let's make some introductions. Who are these biological gremlins you speak of?
I'm glad you asked. So Pleased to Meet Me is about the hidden forces, as I call them. And I describe them basically as four different categories. The very first one's probably not a surprise to too many people, but it refers to the genes in your DNA that you've already alluded to. But what most people don't realize, you know, they think genes build their eye color, their hair color, things like that, these physical traits, but they have far-reaching effects into our personality, mood, and behavior as well, which we can talk about today and explain thoroughly in the book. A corollary to genetics that is more recent in the scientific literature is this wild new science called epigenetics, and this takes into account how the environment interplays with your particular genetic makeup. And that leads to a greater deal of diversity than we've ever appreciated before. The third force that I describe in the book are the genes that are within our microbiome, the trillions of bacteria that reside within us or on our bodies. And then the final hidden force is our subconscious, the things that are going on under the hood in our brain that are driving us to do things when we may not even realize it.
So some of this is new in science, and it really flies in the face of what we've believed or thought we knew about ourselves and how we function. So what is wrong with being wrong about who we are at the core?
So there's nothing really wrong, but I think what we need to do is appreciate the nuts and bolts behind our behavior, because there's a lot of misinterpretation and misunderstanding. And I think this has dramatic repercussions on how we look at ourselves and our own behavior, and importantly, how we treat other people. I think there's a lot of judgment and stigmatism that occurs with a lot of behaviors, and we don't quite understand why certain individuals would do things that we don't dream of doing. And what my book is trying to expose is that it's these hidden forces that are driving the behavior. And a lot of these are outside of our control. So we need to expose these forces if we're going to understand why people do things that we don't.
We're looking at the biological science that drives our personal tastes and our tendencies. Bill Sullivan is author of the book Pleased to Meet Me. Do you hate the taste of certain foods like broccoli or celery, cilantro? Does anyone else in your family feel that way, or is it just you? What do you want to know about why you feel this way? Join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. Bill, almost a decade ago, when scientists were looking to study a remarkable person's DNA, they sought out the rocker Ozzy Osbourne, and they wanted to know what genes had kept him alive through his decades of heavy drug and alcohol abuse. What was going on there with that research?
It's really interesting, isn't it? Because this all occurred back in 2010, when genome sequencing was very expensive and very labor intensive. It wasn't something that you could just do like now, where it's pretty cheap and you can get the results probably in a weekend. So it was a big deal back then. And rather than seeking out some of the world's, you know, most brightest people or most industrious people, they purposely sought out Ozzy Osbourne. This was not Osborne's decision. He said, actually, that the only gene he knew anything about was the guy in Kiss, referring to Gene Simmons. Ozzy's got a wonderful sense of humor, but he was game for this experiment. He was also intrigued by the fact that he was still alive, because he knew he did some pretty dramatic things to his body during his youth with the drug and alcohol addiction and all the partying. So he was equally interested in, was there something in his DNA that could explain his resilience or his proclivity to addiction and so on. So long story short, scientists did sequence his genome, in fact, and they found some never-before-seen mutations, variations, in genes that regulate alcohol metabolism and genes that have been since correlated with a tendency to become addicted to hard drugs. So there are, in fact, some really solid genetic evidence that support a hereditary component to the issues that Ozzy Osbourne struggled with in terms of addiction.
Which also leads us to look at addiction as not something that perhaps is completely in our control, or something like obesity.
Exactly. Those two things go hand in hand. And for the longest time, it was intuitive to think that those conditions were self-inflicted, a failure of willpower. But science shows it's far more complicated than that. Genes clearly make some people more susceptible to food or drug addiction, so it's not simply a matter of self-control. Some people, for example, have thrifty metabolism genes that are maladaptive in today's calorie-rich world, and some people have a gene for a sweet tooth, whereas some don't have that, and that's obviously going to affect weight. Some people have genes that build hyperactive brains, and that provokes them to use alcohol as a source to quiet the chaos in their head, which can possibly lead to alcoholism. There's even evidence that our microbiome, these trillions of bacteria in our gut, can influence cravings for junk food or even the ability to stay sober. So like you said, we can treat conditions like this more effectively by learning the biology behind them rather than dismissing it as a lifestyle choice.
Let's bring in Doug now in Reedsburg. Doug, hi.
Hi there. I just 9 days ago had a brand new baby boy, and my wife would always, I would always stretch. And when I'd stretch, I'd make a grunt or noise, and my wife would be like, "Why do you have to do that? I can stretch and not make any noise." Well, our brand new baby boy does the exact same thing, and he is not old enough to have learned any sort of behavior from me, but he does it automatically from the day he was born.
Wow. I love the story, Doug. What do we know there, Bill?
I love that story, too. And I have not come across any specific studies that talk about stretching. That's really intriguing. But I have come across numerous studies where new parents, just like yourself, are just genuinely surprised at the power of genetics and heredity. We see these little quirks and traits like that emerging in children that obviously were too young to learn them. They just seem to be born instinct, you know? And we see that time and time again. I have my own story with broccoli. You know,
and we're going to have to pause there on broccoli. You said the B word. We can't go any further. Bill Sullivan, a professor of pharmacology and microbiology at Indiana University School of Medicine. His new book is called Please to Meet Me. You can join in with your questions, your observations. Have you ever taken a DNA test? What do you know about who you are based on your genes? Share your experience, your questions, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with broccoli here on the Ideas Network. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. And our biological gremlins, they've been at work, long been at work, driving our actions, our personality, whether we need coffee this morning or not. The book is called Please to Meet Me, and Bill Sullivan writes that every human behavior, from addiction to attraction to anxiety, it's all tethered to a genetic anchor. How has the world around you, the environment you're in, affected who you are? Has trauma as a child or an adult changed your personality, your behavior, your understanding about who you are? Are you glowingly optimistic much of the time, or is the glass half empty and leaking? Tell us about your circumstances, your questions you have about your individual tendencies at 800-642-1234. And author Bill Sullivan stays with us. He's a professor at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Bill, you hate broccoli, as we just established. Your wife loves it. Your children reacted differently to it. One liked it, but the other acted as though you were trying to poison her. What do we know about DNA and how it affects things like taste?
So this is a problem that has plagued me all of my life. So I know broccoli's nutritious. I know I should eat it. It's good for me, blah, blah, blah. But when it hits my tongue, I just want to gag. I just can't stand this vegetable and others in its family like cauliflower and kale. And like you said, my son, just like my wife, he can tolerate this vegetable fine. I just stare at them in amazement as they shovel this into their mouth. And I'm like, why can't I do that? My poor daughter is just like me. She'd get a whiff of broccoli and she already starts running for the hills, right? So what is the difference here? What's going on? So it turns out there's actually some genetics behind this, and I actually got myself tested to absolutely verify and prove to my parents that I'm a mutant, and this is why I can't stomach the broccoli. And that's why, as a kid, I couldn't eat it. So it turns out the gene in question here, interestingly enough, is called TASTER, TASTER 28, and it builds a taste bud receptor. So this gene can be mutated. There's variations that can occur around it or within it that can create a dramatic enhancement of bitter flavors. So all food is composed of chemicals, of course, and some of those, especially in plants, are bitter alkaloids and other bitter compounds. So the variations in my taste bud receptor result in two different things. First, they increase a lot more of a taste receptor that binds to bitter chemicals. And there may also be structural differences in my taste bud receptor that give those bitter chemicals a bear hug, whereas in most people, it just kind of gives them a fist bump. It doesn't bind very tightly. So when those bitter chemicals hit my tongue, they really do register a much stronger bitter taste. And that's a warning, evolutionary speaking, to my body that what I'm eating might be toxic, might be a poison. So I don't apologize for this anymore. I'm among the 25% of people that scientists call super tasters, and we have this genetic variation in our taste bud receptors. And I find that both vindicating and a little unsettling at the same time.
And you have a little test you can even do to figure out whether you might be a super taster involving putting some blue dye on your tongue.
That's correct. This test is one of the ways you can assess how many taste buds are roughly on your tongue in a given area. So you take one of those little reinforcement circles that stick to loose leaf paper when the holes tear. And after you put some blue food coloring on your tongue, which will stain everything except the taste buds will look a little pink, slap that little reinforcement ring onto your tongue and count the number of taste buds. I think the number is about 30, but if it's 30 or higher, then you would be considered a super taster because you're expressing a lot more of those taste buds than normal people.
Well, let's take another call now. Stephanie is in Racine. Hi, Stephanie.
Hi. Good morning.
Good morning.
Hi. I was just calling because your program is really, I'm really happy to hear it because I've always thought there's something about my body that is really aversive to smoking, even though...
Oh, Stephanie, I think you dropped. Are you still there? No, it looks like she's not. She's always noticed that when she was a teen, when she tried to smoke, her body wouldn't do it. Stephanie, are you there? No, she's not. So, but she did say that her parents were addicted to nicotine and thinks that she should be studied in some way because she simply is not addicted to nicotine or isn't is repulsed by it.
That's a very interesting case because you usually see the opposite. Nicotine and other toxic substances like this have been shown to alter DNA at an epigenetic level, and this can happen while the baby is still in the womb. It's a concept that's called fetal programming, and this doesn't involve changes in the DNA code itself. Epigenetics refers to chemical modifications that can take place on the DNA or with the proteins that associate with DNA. And the end result is that the genes can become expressed in different levels. They can be turned on, off, or somewhere in between. So that's the concept of epigenetics, and it usually underlies like a predisposition to some of the behaviors that the parents are doing while the child is in the womb. So it is really striking to have a child born of parents who smoke but does not have that proclivity. And what's probably going on there is some kind of epigenetic environmental influence that has made this an exception to the rule.
Yeah, what influence does the environment have? Can violence or negative behavior have a true impact on what our genes do and how they're expressed?
That was one of the most striking things that I found during the course of the research for this book. I had no appreciation, you know, you can imagine how environmental substances like lead or endocrine disruptors could potentially alter DNA and gene expression, but you would never think at the get-go that psychological things like adverse childhood experiences, abuse, neglect, or bullying can also scar the DNA utilizing these epigenetic mechanisms. So again, we're not talking about changes in the DNA sequence. We're talking about changes of chemical modification of the DNA itself or the proteins associating with it. So it seems that children who are exposed to these terrible adverse experiences grow up to be at a higher predisposition for aggression, depression, other behavioral problems, and even suicide. So scientists have just assumed that this was largely a cultural thing. This was a damaging psychological environment. But at the end of the day, that doesn't really tell us too much. It doesn't reveal a molecular mechanism that we can do something with it. So what scientists have found through epigenetics sciences is that these adverse childhood experiences are actually putting marks on the DNA at stress management genes. For example, one of these genes that is affected is the glucocorticoid receptor. It happens to undergo a process called DNA methylation in children that are bullied or exposed to other adverse experiences. DNA methylation is an epigenetic mark that turns the gene off. So without a glucocorticoid receptor, stress hormones accumulate in the body to very toxic levels, and it's thought that those lead to the behavioral problems that we usually see in children that are exposed to these horrible environments.
And you write about this in such a beautiful way. You say that DNA builds the house, but something else decides what makes it a home. So the environment can really impact our DNA to that degree.
That's right. For the longest time, scientists and even non-scientists have basically been debating what is more important. Is it nature, your genes, or is it nurture, your environment, your culture, things like that? And it turns out that this is really the wrong debate to be having, because nature and nurture really are the same thing. They're two sides of the same coin. And thanks to the science of epigenetics, which has really blossomed in the last 10 to 15 years, we're finding out exactly how the environment influences DNA, which fills in the black box that has plagued us for so long.
So as a parent, a mother is pregnant and eating for, and certainly, you know, basically eating for whatever the child is going to be having a little taste of whatever she puts in her mouth. What impact can that have on the tendencies of the child after they're born?
We're finding that it can have a tremendous impact, and the mechanism is through this fetal programming process that I talked about earlier. Interestingly enough, there's even some emerging data that suggests the father's diet or the father's habit can even influence the child. prior to conception, because junk food, diets, exposure to drugs or nicotine has been associated with DNA methylation changes that can take place in the sperm cells prior to conception. So there's a higher rate of, for example, breast cancer in daughters born to men who were smoking prior to the pregnancy. So we're not letting men get off the hook here either. But like you said, the mother's environment is critical for the child's development while still in the womb. And the biological reason is because the DNA is being pre-programmed to match mom's environment. And that makes evolutionary sense. The baby is going to be born into mom's environment, or at least that's what nature assumes. So it's proper to prepare that child for the environment that mom is currently in.
And we're going to pause right there with Bill Sullivan as our guide. The book is called Please to Meet Me. Coming up, we look at how microbes produce thousands of biochemicals and neurotransmitters that affect how we feel. That's right after this news update. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. We're learning about our DNA, our blueprint of life, and how it goes well beyond our physical characteristics. It's a conversation about genetics here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Our genome contains about 21,000 genes scattered across 46 chromosomes, 23 from mom, 23 from dad. We're finding out how embedded we are within our genome, that there are many potential versions of ourselves. Have you noticed that what's going on inside your body, that it's affected your behavior? And if you've seen how what's happening around you, how that's affected how you feel inside, what questions do you have about nature and nurture colliding? Join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. Bill Sullivan is our guide. He's a pharmacology and microbiology professor at the Indiana University School of Medicine. His new book is called Please to Meet Me, Genes, Germs, and the Curious Forces That Make Us Who We Are. Let's go back to the phones now with John joining us from Boaz. Hi, John.
Good morning. I was wondering if our fathers and our grandfathers and our mothers and our grandmothers handed down some of their life situations, such as Northern Germany experienced wars, and my grandfather survived World War One. My dad survived World War Two, but that was embedded in their genes when they made me.
John, thank you for the call. What do we know about wars and strife, and how that perhaps can impact generations later?
That's a fantastic question, John. I appreciate that. And science is actually on the case. They're very interested in some of the issues that you've outlined. And this is a concept that scientists refer to as transgenerational epigenetic inheritance. It's a rather controversial subject because it really turns a lot of what we understand about evolution on its head, because it's the idea that a parent's experiences can somehow alter the DNA and behavior of children or even grandchildren. So let me introduce the concept. I'll definitely circle back to the World War study, but let me introduce the concept by telling you about this fascinating experiment that was done in mice that solidifies this argument for transgenerational epigenetic inheritance. So mice normally love the smell of cherries, but not if they're shocked while they sniff the scent. So when that happens, the mouse develops a fear of the cherry smell. So if that mouse is mated and has pups, the remarkable thing is those pups are born fearing the smell of cherries. They were never shocked. They never saw their parents get shocked. But it's like this brand new instinct that came up out of nowhere. Even more remarkably, the children of those pups still afraid of cherries. So you have the grandchildren that have this weird cherry phobia that was instilled in the grandparents. So this is a fascinating concept, and the mechanism is through epigenetics. The evidence that this might occur in humans relates to the hunger famine of World War II. This is when the Germans issued a blockade of the Netherlands, and there was a catastrophic famine there. So it turns out that mothers who were starved during their pregnancy had children who grew up with higher rates of obesity and diabetes. Their genome was epigenetically programmed to survive a famine by maximizing calorie extraction from food. But of course, there's no famine today. So those tweaks to their genome are now causing obesity because they're maladaptive. So our bodies seem to program DNA in response to the environment so our offspring have better chances of survival in that environment.
So let's bring in microbes to the conversation. Just how early are they introduced into our lives, and how do they influence what is happening in our DNA?
This is a really underappreciated topic that is now gaining some traction, both with respect to the scientific evidence and the fact that microbiome is more or less becoming a household term by this point. So for those who aren't familiar, the microbiota or the microbiome refer to the 3 pounds of bacteria that are in our gut. So 3 pounds is a lot of material. These things are tiny at an individual level, but 3 pounds is about the equivalent weight of your brain. So it turns out that put all these bacteria together, they have an enormous impact on our well-being and behavior. They affect all sorts of things, from our food cravings to our mood to our appetite, and maybe even to what degree we might be aggressive. So the remarkable tool that came along, developed by Jeffrey Gordon several years ago, was the germ-free mouse. These are mice that are born lacking gut microbes, so they don't have any microbes whatsoever. And this allows scientists to put in various species of bacteria to see what happens. So studies with these germ-free mice show that the mice will start overeating if given bacteria from an obese person. Germ-free mice will exhibit signs of depression if given bacteria from a depressed person. Microbes from a brave mouse will make a timid one more adventurous. And that's just the microbiome in our gut. There's other microbes like Toxoplasma gondii, which can go to your brain and possibly influence behavior as well.
You also explore our behavior through our political tendencies and perhaps some biological basis for conservatism or liberalism. Where are you going with that?
I didn't expect this one at all. This one really hit me out of the blue. If there's anything that we think we have agency or decision-making abilities, it's our politics, where we fall on the political end of the spectrum. I was completely surprised that there's both genetic data and a lot of good psychological brain studies that really show that there is a bona fide difference in the biology of liberals versus conservative. So let's begin with the genetic evidence. There is a gene that comes up study after study that seems to divide conservatives and liberals, and it centers on a gene that encodes a dopamine receptor in the brain. So dopamine is a critical neurotransmitter that governs our motivation to obtain a reward. It makes us feel good. Some people have a dopamine system that is tuned down a bit. They have a variation in that receptor so that they require quite a bit more dopamine in order to feel the same pleasurable experience. So when the DRD4, when that receptor is mutated, it encourages risk-taking behavior, novelty-seeking, exploratory behavior. And these are traits that are generally associated with liberals. So that's a pretty fascinating concept to me, that there is a single gene that can perhaps sway where someone falls on the political spectrum.
We're talking with Bill Sullivan. He's a professor at the Indiana University School of Medicine, author of the new book, Pleased to Meet Me. You can join in. Does your whole family share a certain way of thinking or belief? Are you all aligned politically or not? And what do you wonder about how you came to be the way you are? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Bill, this particular DRD4, it's also responsible for some daredevil behaviors. Is that right?
That is correct. So it's a multitasking receptor, but at the end of the day, the main theme across all these different studies. People who take more risks, who are thrill seekers, they need more of a dopamine rush to satisfy that craving in their brain. And they usually find it through these thrill-seeking activities. And this can also predispose people towards addiction, because addiction is associated with dopamine in great capacity, and there's nothing like some of the drugs like cocaine or heroin that can just send dopamine off the charts. So thrill seekers need to be aware of that and perhaps find more healthy outlets in order to get their dopamine rush.
Let's bring in Spencer now, joining us from Menominee. Hi, Spencer.
Hello.
Go ahead.
I was wondering, during my childhood, it was kind of an unfortunate situation. My parents got divorced when I was younger, about 10, 11 years old, and I have seven children total. And so far, four out of us have graduated high school, and three out of four of us have attempted suicide and are kind of depressed, and they didn't really further their education and are, you know, considered obese by many standards, I suppose. And I'm wondering, because I've made myself an exception to this, I'm the one that didn't try suicide, I'm not obese, and I furthered my education. I'm wondering if that's, you know, something to, you know, explain through genetics or, you know, destiny or some type of, you know, thing like that. But I am studying environmental science at Stout. So I'm wondering if it gives me an advantage, you know, having a further education in science to be able to observe and, you know, adapt my situation and my actions based on that.
Spencer, thanks so much for describing your situation in that detail. Bill, what can we take away from his story?
This is a great illustration of the flexibility that can be found in human behavior. And there's still biological drivers behind that. So my heart goes out to the siblings who are struggling with these issues. There's really clear epigenetic data that through fetal programming and through early childhood, it can really set up children who experience these adverse situations for things like depression, suicide, and obesity through mismanagement of the stress response system. But there's also a really intriguing subset of individuals who are exposed to these adverse childhood experiences but are resilient. We see the same thing in soldiers returning home from war. Many of them are susceptible to post-traumatic stress syndrome, but some of them, a small subset, are resistant to this. This has intrigued scientists in recent years, and they're conducting genome-wide studies to get to the bottom of this, to try to figure out if there is a gene in these 20% or so of people who seem resistant to the stress.
Bill Sullivan stays with us explaining the science. His book is called Pleased to Meet Me, and he's a professor at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Still time for your questions, your tendencies, 800-642-1234. Back for more in a minute here on the Ideas Network. You're with us in the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. And if you're starting your morning with coffee, take a moment to contemplate the taste and the need for caffeine. We're learning how our genes influence our preferences for things like caffeine, how we metabolize it, and a zillion other things. You're with us on this journey through genetics, and Bill Sullivan is our guide. His book is called Pleased to Meet Me, Genes, Germs, and the Curious Forces That Make Us Who We Are. Let's go back to the phones now. Doug is joining us from Lansing, Iowa. Hi, Doug.
Hello. Yes, I have a question. I'm a wildlife biologist, retired, and I've always intrigued with the fear of snakes. People, you know, my mother was scared to death of snakes, and I automatically assumed that she learned it from her parents or she learned it from someone else. But in questioning people about it, I'm just wondering if it's something that's not passed on through an experience from parents or grandparents.
What do we make of snakes, Bill?
Well, even Indiana Jones hated snakes, so... This is something that actually goes way back into our evolutionary past. Even other primates have this innate fear of snakes. To the best of my recollection, human beings only have two innate fears, the fear of falling and the fear of snakes. So this is something that goes way back into our evolutionary past. So I don't think this is something recent that maybe our parents have had an adverse experience to. I mean, maybe that has helped to amplify it. But to my understanding, people are pretty much born with an innate fear of snakes. And it's even been attributed to why we have developed such remarkably good eyesight. It's to spot those snakes.
We had a caller who couldn't stay with us, wanted to know about how our genes impact our religious beliefs. Do our genes determine in any way our tendency to be religious or not?
Really good question. People have been after genes of belief for quite some time. And I think a lot of those studies either come up short or don't really point to a very satisfying explanation at present. So what could be analogous to this are like genes for language. There seems to be a short window in our development, very young in life, where we're very receptive to learning a language and very receptive to mimicking what we are taught by our parents. So that is usually when religion is instilled into a child. So it happens very early on, and I think I referred to it as kind of like a tattoo on the brain. But what's really interesting to contemplate is that it's really not much more of a choice than the language that we inherit.
Let's touch on embryo editing here for a moment as we look forward to the next era of genetics and where we take this. There was this international commission that met this week to develop some kind of less ambiguous guidelines for embryo editing. Embryo gene editing has been in the news with these twin baby girls when they were embryos. So what are the ethics around this?
Ooh, we could talk for a whole nother hour on that one. So this is something that we have to address very soon because, like you said, last year, two baby girls were presumably born who were they changed their genes using this editing tool called CRISPR. And this is a revolutionary tool that has come on the scene the past several years that allows us to edit genes with exquisite precision, unlike any other technology that's been discovered so far. So it can be really powerful, but it can also be really dangerous, and it can open up an ethical can of worms. There's two different categories that we need to consider. The first of which is editing genes in a developed person, either a young adult or an older adult. Editing the somatic cells, the body cells, is far safer to contemplate because that's not going to be passed on to the germline, at least not by any mechanism we can see. But editing embryos is much more sticky area because that's a permanent change to the DNA and it will be inherited. It will be a change that is sewn into the fabric of human evolution. So it is far more profound than something like gene therapy, which is being developed to medicinally treat someone.
So what guidelines do we need for scientists? What would they be even adhered to as the scientific community is really pushing this forward?
Obviously, there's going to be renegades. We've had one already. But the vast majority of scientists are for a total ban of editing the germline because that's going to fundamentally alter the course of our evolution in ways that we simply don't know enough how to make an intelligent prediction as to how this is going to work. Hopefully this won't be the case, but those two girls that were edited at the genome level may have catastrophic effects that have nothing to do with the particular changes to those genes, but they're kind of like a downstream effect that we couldn't predict. Because as we're finding, genes often do much more than one thing in the body. So if you tweak something here, it's going to have an effect somewhere else. And we simply just don't know enough. We don't have enough information about how genes work to go tinkering with the germline right now.
Well, we have time for just one more call here. Raymond in Milwaukee. Hi, Raymond.
Hi, I'm calling about a parasite in the environment that lives its life cycle through cats and mice. And when the cats are exposed to this parasite, which apparently the cats excrete in their urine or their feces, the mice become kind of, they want to hang out with the cats, which normally they wouldn't do. So when they find this same parasite in the human brain, these are the people that often are victims of motorcycle crashes and whatnot. And they've also associated, I think it's toxo,
Bill wants to jump in here. He's so excited.
I'm chomping at the bit. Yes, Raymond, my friend, you're talking about Toxoplasma gondii. This is a single-celled parasite that I've been studying since the 90s. I'm fascinated with it. And what's remarkable is that many people on Earth are infected with this parasite, about one-third of the planet, which is about as many people that use Facebook. So we're talking billions of people have this parasite in their heads and they don't even know about it. We can get it from cats. It's excreted in their feces. We can also get it from undercooked meat or simply out in the environment wherever a cat might have done his or her business. So you are right. There is this erasing of the instinct of mice to fear cats when they become infected with the parasite. It's a pretty remarkable change to see that vanish. And there's an evolutionary reason, because the cat is the only organism where the parasite completes the sexual stage of its life cycle. So it basically found a way to re-engineer the mouse brain to get into the belly of a cat. Pretty remarkable feat. But what does that mean when the parasite also gets into a human brain? Well, humans aren't jumping into lion cages at the zoo, but there are emerging studies that suggest the presence of toxoplasma in the brain in a subset of people predispose them to various neuropsychoses, including schizophrenia, rage disorder, and heightened anxiety, and even risk-taking. What you mentioned about the proclivity to traffic accidents is also true. People infected with the parasite seem to have slower response times, and there's a 3 times higher frequency that they will be involved in a car accident.
So as we wrap up here, how confident are you that you would be able to absolutely eradicate toxoplasma?
I hope to do it. Many other labs hope the same. This parasite does not belong in our brain and could be affecting our behavior in unforeseen ways. We found a remarkable new drug in the lab in the past several years called guanabens. It's an old drug that was used for blood pressure, believe it or not. And at least in certain strains of mice, this drug can reduce the brain cyst 70 to 80% of what they are in untreated mice. So we're very encouraged by that and are continuing research along those lines.
Bill, thank you so much for joining us.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks for having me on the show.
Bill Sullivan is a pharmacology and microbiology professor at the Indiana University School of Medicine, where he's studying genetics and infectious disease. His new book is called Pleased to Meet Me: Genes, Germs, and the Curious Forces That Make Us Who We Are. This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to the Ideas Network.